to the GBC Big Three podcast, a weekly podcast where we sit down and unpack three big questions raised from our Sunday sermon. I'm your host, Matt Willis, and joining me for the Big Three for another week is the delightful Jessica Baker. Welcome, Jessica Baker.
Hey, Matt. How are you going?
Good, my friend. How are you going?
Yeah, very good. Yeah. Very good.
Now, for those listening in at home, we've been talking about Huxley. It's been a little bit of a stress trigger for you the last few weeks. So I wanted to talk
just
about something.
Pause. Yeah.
We just want to pause it for you, you know, a little bit of self-care, some boundaries. It's important.
Very good.
So I wanted to talk to you about something, you know, less stressful.
Ah.
You're preaching in 2 weeks' time.
Is that less stressful? I don't know. The combo of the two has been a sheer delight. Yes, I am preaching.
In the PM, yeah. 4th of July.
Yeah, terrifying. No one jot down that date. No one.
Everyone, bring your notebooks and, you know, be ready to just experience the revelation of God through Jess.
Oh.
How are you feeling?
Yeah, I'm nervous.
So
I'm really nervous.
We're returning to the On This Rock series, which is foundational text. So, you know, a passage that's been significant for you. Are you, you know, you threw me under the bus last week asking for a little one-liner intro of my sermon.
Ooh.
You know, Jess, what should we expect?
A couple of days ago, I would have had no idea, but I've done a lot of prayer,
The Spirit has led.
It's the only way this is going to happen. And we're kind of doing a deep dive into Jessica's psyche over the last, you know, the teenage years, and then everything's resurfaced again as an adult.
Ooh.
Yeah, yeah. Big existential questions, obviously.
Way.
You know, you said when you did your sermon, like, I'm out of my teenage angst years, so like, I'm not going to preach on something teenage angsty. I'm going there.
You're going there.
I am going there.
I'm going deep and I'm going hard.
Unless I've got a meeting with Mark Rader after this, unless like that idea is crap, you might see something completely different.
Oh my gosh.
But yeah, I'm going there.
Yeah, excellent. All right. Yeah.
Which I think as a youth leader, I see a lot of these kind of questions cropping up, but also as an adult, I don't think they just disappear.
Yeah.
So I'm going to address it as an adult.
I'm here for it.
I'm here to be vulnerable.
I love a little bit of angst, though. It really just, you know, it brings it home for me.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I'll speak directly
alone.
To you
yes,
then,
please
Matt,
do.
The whole time.
Everyone
well,
else I'll be in the front row
with
my Bible and my notepad.
Yeah, I'm terrified.
Pulling funny faces to make, you know, to make you feel uncomfortable.
Please do. The Spirit will lead. The Spirit will take the wheel. It's going to be fine.
It's going to be amazing.
Yeah.
Well, the reason that we're returning to the On This Rock series is because last Sunday we wrapped up our discipleship pilot, our discipleship cycle that we've been doing for term two. It was a banger.
It was
so,
a banger.
And, you know, we went out with a bang because we had these incredible plans to meet down in the national park. We had a reflection prepared about, you know, where God is in creation and how we can experience revelation of God. And then it just poured. It just bucketed with rain and it was freezing cold and ain't nobody got time for that. So we had to cancel it. So what a way to end our pilot with just a cancelled activity.
Plans.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful. Yeah. But, you know, Grace.
Would have been good.
Would have been.
I would have been there.
Yeah. With Huxley.
Huxley's not allowed in the National Park.
Oh, heavy days.
So probably wouldn't have been there because I've got a child to look after.
I'm sorry. Sorry that I triggered you. But we did still meet as a community in the PM. Mark Rader. Walked us through, see the pun, because we didn't get to walk through the bush.
That was great.
Yeah, did you like that?
Yeah, that was beautiful.
You're welcome.
Carry on.
Walked us through this reflection on God as the creator of the natural world, but how that also ties into the moral world and how the two are kind of interconnected and how when you experience one, you get to experience the other. It was a great time, and we as tables kind of discussed our own experiences of kind of moments where we've been in creation have really gotten a sense of who God is. And so today we want to kind of dive deeper into that and kind of keep going with it. So as we have done with our kickoff weeks during the discipleship cycle, we've done a fourth question. Mm-hmm. So just, you know, each kickoff has had, I guess, a different focus, and this focus was God in creation. So we want to do a fourth question, kind of looking about, you know, creation and some of the questions that come up for us as Christians and how that then impacts our discipleship. So it's going to be a good time. Get ready for it.
I am ready.
Okay, I'm glad. you're looking me in the eyes.
I'm ready.
I don't know
Matt.
If there's fear or enthusiasm, but I'll take either.
No, I love the world. I love what Mark has to say. Let's get into it.
You've been on a huge, like, I want to restore and renew all things in the, you know, creation.
Yeah, trying to.
Yeah. So, you know, this is your jam.
This is my jam. Moment. I'm like a vegan who's been given a platform. I'm not a vegan, but if I was, I'm like a vegan who's been given a microphone. I'm ready to go.
Glorious, glorious. All right. Well, then there's only one thing missing, and that is Mark Rader himself. So, Mark, welcome to the big three.
Thanks, Matt. Hi, Jess.
Hi. Welcome.
Thank you.
It's very formal.
Oh, very
today.
Formal.
Yes. Well, ladies and gentlemen.
You always call her Jessica Baker.
Well, yeah, I just don't know.
That is a little bit formal.
It's a term of endearment, I think.
Thanks.
Isn't it?
Yeah, sure.
Well, it is from my perspective. You're just there like,
no,
oh,
I appreciate
gosh,
it. It's like a nickname, but it's my full name. There's been zero creativity got into that nickname.
It's ironic almost. here we go. If I'm going to go full names, is it Mark Todd Rader?
Yes.
There
Maybe
we
Marcus?
Go.
Mark Marsilius?
No. No.
Just Mark. Just okay.
With a C. And Mark with a C, not with a K.
And it's one of the, it's kind of one of the strange bits because I don't know why my parents did that. Like, I don't know why they just, like, because it wasn't Marcus, it wasn't, they just decided to
go. Because having to correct everyone for your entire life builds character.
I guess.
Wanted you to have strong character.
Although when I went to school, there were like a couple of Marks in my class. But one was with a C and one was with a K. So the normal for me was with a C until I got into the real world and realized, oh,
you are the
there are only
the
two of us.
Yeah, so. I had a Matthew with one T and I was just like, you're just the lesser of the two. I'll pray for you.
It was just mild bullying in primary school from that.
Jeez. Just a little insight to my teenage angst.
Wow. Yeah, that's right. The lines between people, like, you know, the tiers. It's, you know, a stratified
My
community.
My name is superior.
Well, yeah, to any Matts out there with one T, just know your place. not the purpose of the podcast today to just shame people for the way that they spell their names.
Yeah. Although or their parents spell
their
names.
Parents. Yes. Although that should be a conversation. Mark, we've wrapped up the discipleship cycle. Mm. What was the biggest highlight for you in this pilot that we've just finished?
I think that the one of the strongest pieces of feedback was how much people enjoyed the opportunity to chat with people who are older or younger than they were. I guess I wasn't surprised because that's kind of how we set it up, but I was surprised. Like, I think that took me, I didn't think it would be such a big thing, but in reality, you know, the opportunity to, prior to, you know, how we would normally run, say, a normal Sunday service, I might say hello to the person next to me who may be older or younger than I am, but like that's the level of engagement. We actually asked people to have conversations, and so there was some really strong feedback of people just kind of going, this is great.
Yeah.
So, you know, like my youngest daughter, she's gotten to know a couple of the older ladies in the evening congregation. And
am I one of the older ladies she's gotten to know?
No, oh my gosh. Triggered.
Yeah.
Triggered.
Oh,
wow.
I talk to Lucy all the time.
No one make any sudden movements. Yes,
that's right.
Jess is on edge.
I don't think 25 qualifies.
I was thinking older.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Moving on.
And that's just been, and she's really enjoyed that. And they really enjoyed that. So I think that was the big deal.
Yeah.
I think that was the most striking component. Yeah. You just kind of like, oh, that's a bit of an, not an added bonus because we were going to try to do it, but I just didn't anticipate that that would be so strongly appreciated.
Yeah, yeah. How about you, Jess? What was your highlight for the discipleship cycle?
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. I think that was something I've been really missing or lacking. I came to this church as an adult, so I didn't grow up knowing the older women as like my mum's friends and things. Mm. So to sit and chat with some of the older women that are not myself was something I really love doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that I haven't necessarily gotten a chance to before or haven't actively sorted out because I'm an anxiety-ridden mess.
Yeah.
But yeah, to be forced to sit down or even like Esther's little think tank thing. What do we call it? What was the
actual? Incubators?
Yeah, great incubators. On prayer, I got the opportunity for like Adele, Ezzy and Barb to pray for me. And I was like, this has never happened before. I love this. It was, it was delightful.
And it makes you realize starved isn't the right word. Like, you talk about your anxiety. I talk about my neediness. Like, you know, so
gosh,
I'm just I'm a stage five clinger. give me just an ounce of love and you'll never get rid of me.
That's what happened to me.
But, You realize just how much you want it. Like once you start to have that interaction, because I think I had the same, like just having the opportunity to actually meet my community and everyone who's a part of it, because we all sit in the same seats every Sunday. Yeah. Like, and, you know, when we go out to dinner, we tend to sit with the same people and all that kind of stuff. And it was just this amazing opportunity to kind of hear new experiences, new reflections. And I think on top of that, that needing, like what the discussions kind of allowed, as much as it was intergenerational relationships, it was also that immediate response to what we were hearing. I loved that. I was just like, oh, I can't just be passive here. I can't just be a spectator. I can't just consume a message and then go off on my merry way. Like, I'm being asked to respond here and now, even if it is just to consider, even if it is just to hear other people's reflections, which made it just, it just kind of cemented it into my mind and in extension, my week moving forward, which really helped, I think, in my discipleship.
Yeah, and I think one of the other components of the intergenerational component was, like, we didn't do anything deliberate to do it. I think that's what I found. It wasn't like we're like, okay, we're going to, like, be really purposeful. We're going to mix the tables up. Like, we wanted to mix them up, but we didn't really do much. And so I think that that hunger for that intergenerational relationship kind of really came to the fore. So people are like, I really want to know my community. I want to know the older women. I want to know the younger women. I want to know, you know, I want to know people around me who are part of my community, people I recognize. Like, I see Matt all the time. I see Jess all the time, but I never talk to them. And here's an opportunity. And so I think there was something really quite remarkable about how little, how much bang for our buck we got.
Yeah.
Particularly when we didn't really invest anything in it. You know, like, it just kind of happened. It was just this really organic, lovely reaction. Yeah.
Another amazing thing that I thought came out of it was there was someone who was new to church. Like, it was his first time and I never would have talked to him. I don't think maybe one person would have talked to him or caught him, but we were in the incubator thing. So we actually prayed with him. He prayed for us and we had a big long, it was terrifying for him, I'm sure.
Of all the weeks to visit.
Though, welcome. So.
But you don't miss people who are new. You catch everyone.
That's remarkable. It was great. It was great.
It was amazing. Yeah. And now let's take this opportunity, I guess, to wrap up by finishing the conversation of Sunday night's discussion, which is God and creation, by looking at the fourth question. So let's get into it. So Mark, as I said before, you reflected for us the connection between the natural order and the moral order and how God is the creator of both and how you can see reflections of God in both and reflections of each in each other, it seemed. So I guess we wanted to take an opportunity to keep going with that conversation. I think creation has a lot of opportunities for us in our discipleship. How do we approach creation from a scientific perspective? How do we approach creation from a spiritual perspective and experiencing God in that space? What's our role within creation? Jess has gone really hard on that. So I'm going to ask a super broad question, but I think these are the things that we kind of want to unpack for us as we kind of figure it out. But what does it mean that God is the creator and how does this impact our discipleship?
Okay, that is general.
It is general. You're welcome. Let's see,
where should I go with that? Well, I mean, let me just kind of briefly reflect on what I said on Sunday night, because I think one of the challenges that we often have as Christians, and this is in part because of the scientific age in which we live, we kind of draw a line between the created order, the material order, and the spiritual.
Yeah.
And while they are different, I think we do need to, you know, like, I think the West has almost divorced those two. And they're starting, I think, to kind of come back together a little bit. But I think it's really important that we recognize what it means when we say that God is the creator. Because I think, again, when we think about creation, we think about the material world.
Yeah.
And maybe we think about, you know, like, angels and demons and, you know, whatever, you know, like the spiritual
just
things,
casually,
you know, that God may have created as well. But one of the reflections that I shared on Sunday night was that for God to be the creator, he created not only the material but the moral universe, right? So this was an insight that I stumbled upon when I was doing some study in the book of Job, right? So Job, you remember the story, he's a godly man, we're told, which is important in the context of the story because he then suffers, right? And that's that's the problem. So we know he's a good man. God himself has said he's a good man, and yet he still suffers. And there's no reason for the suffering at all. So it's meaningless suffering. What do we do with that, right? Mm. It's the classic, why do bad things happen to good people?
Yeah.
Right? So that sets it all up. But Job's first utterance, the first thing that he says in chapter 3 is essentially this, it's filled with language of uncreation. Mm. So he talks about wanting there to be darkness rather than light, right? That the stars would no longer shine, like kind of undoing the created good. And one of the scholars that I was reading when I was studying the book of Job basically made the observation that the suffering of a good person, as far as Job is concerned, calls into question the entire created order, right? Like if the moral universe is unraveling, it's only a matter of time before the material universe also begins to unravel because they're linked together.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really important component. So like I reflected on Sunday night that, you know, like some of the, shall I say, the moral or ethical truths, like why is honesty the best policy? Why does hard work usually pay off? Well, it's not just because of an accident in the universe. It's because that's how God made the world. Mm. Like he made the world so that honesty is generally the best policy, that hard work generally pays off. Like that's how it works. Our ideas of justice have been built into the world. They've been created in the world. And so when we come across injustice or when we come across that undeserved suffering, we're like, ah, what's gone wrong? Mm. And Job just really connects the two things together. We tend to divorce them, right?
Yeah.
So the question of suffering is a question of the moral, ethical, theological world. We don't really think much at all about how that impacts the material.
Yeah.
And I think what's so important about that then is that when God says that he is going to restore and renew all things, again, we can tend to have almost two agendas. Mm. There's kind of there's the moral stuff. He's going to bring justice and righteousness and peace and all that sort of stuff. And we kind of go, oh, yeah, and then there'll be like a new heaven and a new earth and stuff. So like, you know, nice trees and less pollution. and we kind of disconnect them rather than kind of going, no, these things are connected. So when God says, I'm going to restore and renew all things, he means the created order, but he also means the moral order because they're built together, like they're built together. And I think that then feeds into our sense of mission. Like what is Jesus doing? Well, he's about the environment, but he's not about the environment alone. Mm. He's about justice, but he's not about injustice alone. These things are combined, you know. Mm. So when Job and his friends at the end of their long-winded conversation about how
much this sucks,
and their incomplete, partial answers to that are all wrong, right? They're all wrong. God shows up and intriguingly doesn't answer their questions about justice or suffering. He takes them on a tour of the universe. Right? Do you understand how the stars work? Do you understand how these animals function? Do you get how the sea creatures, like, do you get any of that? And the kind of the unstated statement in that is, like, if you don't understand the material world, how are you going to understand the moral world? Mm. Like, the stuff you can see and taste and observe, you don't even understand that. So why don't you just trust me on... on the other part, is kind of the implicit question. And I think that then creates a good spot for us to grapple with questions of injustice and questions of righteousness and all of those sorts of things. Because God doesn't come angry that they've discussed it or that they've got it so horribly wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, he points out that, yeah, you may have missed the mark a little bit on this one, but nonetheless, you know, yeah, that's right.
I've never gotten anything wrong. Just FYI.
So I think that's the significance of when we say God is creator. Like I think that's part of the significance because it shapes our understanding of the mission that Jesus is on.
Mm. I think that's interesting because so for me my next question is, so then how do we approach the creation story that makes no reference to the moral?
Oh,
there we go. Just after I say I'd never get anything wrong, he's just like, let me correct you, Matt Willis.
No, I'm not going to correct you.
Noise I've never heard. Oh, you're so wrong.
Is it? Bless the ignorance of the young, he says.
I didn't even know what we're talking about, to be honest. So.
Okay. So So I think the creation story, again, we tend to approach it from a material creation perspective.
Mm. Yeah.
And that's been shaped by the evolutionary debates and all of those sorts of things. And so was it 7 days? Was it not 7 days? Is the order right? Blah, 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 blah. But I think that there's a whole bunch of stuff in the story that points to a theological rationale for the story itself. Everything from the 7 days, right? Like, because God didn't need 7 days. If he'd wanted to create everything in an instant, he could have created everything in an instant, right? Like, so 7 days has some sort of significance, and it doesn't take much to realize the 7 days of the week and the fact that God rests. And, you know, like, so there's some theological concerns here about patterns of our lives, right? Like that for all that we've been created to do and for all that there is to do, God himself rests, sets that pattern into the created order. But for the people of Israel, I mean, there's some really interesting dynamics of the creation account that are essentially kind of backhands to the stories that the Israelites would have heard, right? The stories of the Babylonian epics, where the gods basically fought amongst themselves. And as a consequence of their war, they ended up creating the world. Right?
Whoops.
Yeah. You know, how the gods basically created humanity because they didn't want to do any work. And so they created people to do the work for them.
I mean, it's clever. Yeah.
I try and do that with my children. It doesn't work. I'm still cleaning up after them.
That's so true.
You know, so there's everything from the fact that God speaks and God speaks alone. Mm. Like, that's a theological statement in that world order. Mm. You know, there are no other gods to speak of, right? If they are, they don't get a say, right? Like, they don't get a say. There's no fight. God just says, let's do this, and that's what happens. Mm. You know, the longest sections are the creation of the things that happen on day three and day six, right? The creation of humanity, where they're created as kind of the pinnacle of the created order. Mm. But then there's the creation of the sun, moon, and stars on day maybe that's on day four. Anyway, the whole piece. But in a world where the sun and the moon and the stars were worshipped, it's intriguing that the author doesn't call them the sun and the moon. He calls them the greater light, the lesser light, and the stars. And so, you know, there's no sense that – and the stars, their job – like the job of all of those creation, of all of those astral elements is to tell you basically when day starts and when it ends and the seasons. That's all they do. They don't control your destiny. They don't control your fate. Mm. There's like, you're not born under a star sign that has anything to do with anything. Like that's not their purpose. And even the fact that God blesses the created order and says, be fruitful and multiply. Like one of the great temptations for the people of Israel was the worship of Baal and Asherah, who were at part fertility gods, right? There was a sense that unless the gods of fertility bring about fertility, we're done. Mm. And God's like, you don't worship fertility. It's built into the natural order. Like, I've built this in. Mm. And so there's a subtext throughout the creation order that basically says, God created the world and there's nothing in all of creation that's worthy of worship apart from him. Like part of the story. And it's like, what are you doing? What are you doing worshiping fertility? Here, let me tell you the story again. God said, be fruitful and multiply. He blessed the creation order. Like there, boom, done. So what are you doing worshiping fertility gods? What are you worshiping the sun, moon, and stars for? Like seriously? Like all they do is kind of, you know, help you to figure out the time and what season it is. You know, you could probably figure that out without them, by the way. Like, you know, if it's cold, it's winter. You know, so you know, there's a whole bunch of stuff I think that contains a theological component to the story that I think is quite important.
So then big question. Mm-hmm. Was creation created in 7 days, or is this a story used for theological interpretation?
I think it's the latter rather than the former. I think there's too many indicators. Everything from, you know, how the story of Genesis 1 compares to the other ancient texts, with which it has a great deal in common. To the poetic form of it, you know, so it opens with the world was formless and empty, and the first 3 days of creation, God basically gives form to things, and the next 3 days, he fills it up. So there seems to be some pattern there. Now, having said that, you know, if God wanted to, you know, order and create everything in 7 days, like, fine, like, no problem. I'm not too fussed one way or the other. He could have done it in an instant, 7 seconds, 7 days, 7 years, 7 ages, a billion years. Like, I don't care. Yeah. Like, I just don't care. I think that
I want to see you keep going with
that. Yeah, that's right. That's right. I'm out of numbers. You know, so because I don't think that's the point of Genesis 1. And if all we get out of Genesis 1 is, oh, I know how the world was created, that's just knowledge.
Mm.
That doesn't really change our life.
Yeah, wow.
What changes our life is knowing that God created the world and there's nothing in all of creation worthy of worship. That changes our lives.
Mm.
Or the idea that, you know, I think that the non-negotiables in Scripture from Genesis 1 are that God created the world. So, you know, whatever else might be said or could be said about evolutionary theory, I don't really buy the fact that it just happened and that there was no God.
Mm.
Like, not only does that sound odd to me, that there was nothing and then accidentally there was, like, that's just strange.
Mm.
Nor does it sit really comfortably with me that there was just random processes for billions of years.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, God was involved in one way, shape, or form. Mm. And also that humanity was created uniquely, right? Mm. So again, I don't think biblically I can say that we're just a slightly more advanced animal.
Mm.
Like, are we related to the animal kingdom? Yeah, there's plenty of evidence of that. But Scripture would say the same.
Yeah.
Mm. Created by God. Mm. But in his image, in a way that the animal kingdom is not, and therefore also with a purpose, right? Mm. Because the image of God is not just saying, oh yeah, you're a little bit like God in some way,
mm.
right? Whether in our will or in our relational capacity or our creativity, whatever the case might be, there's a whole bunch of different options. But also to say that, you know, it seems that in the ancient Near East, the image language was often used to describe kings, right? That the kings were in the image of the gods.
Mm.
And so there's something about humanity that is marked as being special and unique within the created order, and therefore to have a purpose under God on the earth, you know?
Mm.
Be fruitful, multiply, rule the world, have dominion over it, all that kind of stuff. So, so I think that those are the non-negotiables. Mm. God created the world. Humanity is unique within it. How he did it? I don't know. It just seems that we fight about that, and I'm not convinced. Now, again, I find rocks boring, so people out there who love fossils and the fossil record and all that sort of stuff and carbon dating, like, knock yourselves out. And it's worth exploring that, you know? And, you know, I think that some of the claims of, you know, evolution are, like, outrageous. You know, like, I remember watching something on whales, and the narrator said without a trace of irony or without any hint that there could be any other truth than this, that they were descended from, like, swamp wolves that just spent more and more time in the water, and then their nose moved to the top of their head and they lost their legs and became giant. And I was like, I find that hard to believe. but I don't know if that's standard evolutionary theory about where whales came from, but, like, it was just kind of one of those, okay,
yeah.
You can just say that stuff? Like, is that any more ludicrous than saying that God created the world?
Yeah.
I don't know. So, like, you know, there's big, big questions there, but I'm not sure that that's what Genesis 1, 2, and 3 in particular are concerned about.
Mm.
I grew up at a Christian school, and so in science we kind of were taught kind of it's one or the other, and you can't necessarily reconcile the two. How do we, as someone, you know, who's thinking a little bit about the evidence of evolution and things, but also wants to, you know, we don't want to get the Bible wrong or misinterpret, how do we reconcile the two, the Scripture and the creation?
Mm. Well, I think part of it, because as like I'm not much of a scientist, I've already kind of given that away. But
you are a doctor, though. So, you know.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. How far can I make that go? Probably not this far.
Not that far.
But I think that one of the challenges, and I think this is one of the legacies of seeing Scripture as being foundational, is that we assume that foundational means therefore foundational for everything.
Mm.
And I'm not convinced that the Bible is a scientific document.
Mm.
It's a theological one. And therefore, the sorts of statements that Scripture makes about the world are not the same kinds of statements that science makes. Now, I open by saying that God created the material world and the moral world. So there's a connection between them. So we can't just kind of pull them apart and kind of go, science, whatever, you guys go figure yourselves out. But at the same time, I think that there is therefore a place to say, this is what scripture does. This is what science does. Mm. I think that there's lots of stuff in scripture that, reflects the created glory, but it wasn't interested. Like, the authors weren't trying to be scientifically accurate. That wasn't their concern. Mm. They were calling for faithfulness from the people of God. Mm. So I don't think it's one or the other, certainly. Mm. I think it is more than possible. I think it is, in fact, preferable that people are able to hold together the statements of Scripture, the theological statements of Scripture, alongside what they discover about the world through the scientific endeavor. Because essentially what scientists are doing, if I can say from the perspective of theology, is they are observing the world and the way God made it.
Mm.
So, whether they think they are or not, that's what they're doing, right? Like, from the perspective of faith, they are just exploring my Father's world and unpacking the variety and the mystery and the order and the chaos and trying to make sense of the world. And that is essentially the path of wisdom, right? And, wisdom is the whole, because the doctrine of, wisdom literature is based on the doctrine of creation, right? That if God made the moral world, then we should be able to see patterns in it. Just, like farmers know when to plant their seed because of the seasons, and they just kind of work stuff out. Like, if you plant stuff in the middle of winter, it doesn't grow as well. So, let's try it in the spring. Oh, look at that. That's amazing. and they're just working with the world, with the rhythms and patterns of the world. Well, that's also true with wisdom.
Mm.
So a lot of wisdom literature is observational, right? You just observe the world long enough to kind of go, you know what? If you hang out with people who are really given to rage, that doesn't work well for you.
Yeah.
So here's a proverb. If you got a hot-headed friend, maybe not have a hot-headed friend. Like, it's that kind of stuff. Yeah, people who talk all the time seem to get themselves in trouble again and again and again.
Oh my gosh. Story of my life.
I don't know why you chose that example. Yeah. To you?
That felt like a personal attack.
That's a proverb for older women.
Oh, good. Doesn't apply to me.
It's observational. And so science is observational. And so it is a form of wisdom. We're gaining an ability to understand God's world. And so I think if we have an antagonistic view towards science, then I think that we can denigrate what they're doing, when in reality there's an opportunity to celebrate.
Mm.
Now, I think some of the assumptions that they may make, or some of the assumptions that they begin with, that there is no God,
yeah.
And this is all just kind of accidental, and aren't we clever? Eh, I don't know. I'm not convinced that science will save us.
Mm.
it'll help, but that's not the message of Scripture, So I think that we may question some of the assumptions, we may question some of their conclusions. Oh, that's all right. That's part of the scientific endeavor. But I think at the end of the day, I think we can celebrate it. So if you're a scientist out there and a Christian, go figure out God's world.
Yeah.
Tell us what you found. Make some sense of it for us. Help us unpick the mysteries of the created order in order that we might, glorify God, but understand his world and live more effectively within it.
Yeah. It's funny because, like, that whole observing creation is where we can kind of see God in that space. I was having a conversation with a bunch of dads from my son's soccer team on the weekend, and obviously once you say that you're a pastor and you work into a church, a certain type of conversation
evolves.
Thank you. Oh, yes. I love a pun. There was one guy in particular who was like, personally, I can't believe that because of science.
Yeah.
He was just like, yep, the two are just too exclusive. Like, you can't combine the two. And it was interesting because the very next day I was scrolling through Facebook, a reputable source of information,
classic.
Naturally. this little video came up, and it was about how the gravitational pull of Jupiter is constantly saving Earth from meteors. Like,
thanks, Jupiter.
Thank you, Jupiter. Yeah. Love your work. That if it wasn't there, if Jupiter wasn't the size it was and didn't have the gravitational pull, then we'd just be copping it left, right, and center. I don't know how accurate that is, but I took it as
fact.
As fact, as you do on Facebook, because again, reputable source. I'm constantly struck by just the perfection of creation. Mm. Like there, like we've come across no other creature that functions the same way that humans do. Like there is such a gap between us and, you know, the next smartest animal. I don't know. Is that a monkey? Is that a dolphin? I don't know. You know, dolphins are smart.
Dolphins are smart, but I feel like we're mostly related to the monkeys, right? Okay. That's what you hear.
But do you get, you know, the whole, like, if the axis of the earth was 1 degree less or 1 degree more, you know, we'd all self-combust or freeze, like all these kinds of things. I'm like, when I look at creation, I see a perfect plan unfold. I don't like, and this is kind of what you were saying, like, I can't, that is not chance. Like that is not just, you know, a bunch of atoms got together, you know, exploded and like, there you go. You've got the universe.
Waited long enough and this all happened.
Yeah, like this just points to a plan come to fruition to me. Mm. But it is interesting how some people look at it and go, nah, like, no way can science point to a God. And then for others, it's like, well I just see the handiwork of God.
I suspect, though, that some of the it's not so much that science doesn't point to a God, right? As much as it is that there's an underlying assumption that the Bible tells a different story to science. Mm. And I think that's been unhelpful for us. You know, to treat the Bible like a scientific textbook, I think is not a great use of scripture, because it assumes a different genre, and genre is important because it tells you what to expect. Right? Mm-hmm. Like I use this example all the time. If you wanted to go and see a romantic comedy, you go to the theater.
Which I do.
I heard that on Sunday. Yes. Heard that on Sunday morning.
I did say it in my sermon.
Yeah, it's true.
Love a rom-com. Love a rom-com.
Who doesn't? I've been hitting them hard on my annual leave.
Okay, so what I was saying is that if you wanted to go see a romantic comedy, but you went and you accidentally went into the theater that was showing Chainsaw Massacre 4.
It would be an awful day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not about that.
Now, but the issue would be not so much that Chainsaw Massacre 4 was a horrible movie, but that you went into it thinking, I mean, I reckon it is, but you know, that you went into it assuming that it was a romantic comedy. And so what you were expecting was boy meets girl, something happens that means that they might not get together.
Mm. And
they
then get a together. Run to the airport.
And then they get together, right? Like that's the romantic comedy. Whereas in a horror genre, it's different. Boy meets girl, and then it just kind of goes badly. And then massacre, that's right. So you'd walk out going, that was the worst romantic comedy I've ever seen, right? But if you went to your friends and said, oh, I just saw the worst romantic comedy, and you'd like – they'd point out, they'd go, that was a horror film. And you'd be like, oh. So like,
you're a little slow, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Hyperbole, all right? Yeah. The exaggeration make a point. If we come to this text of scripture assuming it is a particular type of genre, we're looking for particular sorts of things. But if we get the genre wrong, then our assessment is not necessarily accurate. So if you go to scripture going, this is a scientific text, I think you're going to be disappointed because you're going to have to defend things like 7-day creation. Now, can you? Apparently you can. People do. But the overwhelming evidence seems to be against that, you know, you have to then defend a young earth, you know, based on the dates. And it's like, I'm not convinced whether the earth is young or old is kind of a secondary question. I'm not convinced that the Bible sets out to answer those. Yeah. I don't think God was like, oh, I'm going to tell the story of kind of the fall and kind of and the plans that I have for the people of Israel. I'm just going to sneak a little bit of science underneath it so that, you know, thousands of years from now, people kind of go, oh, we know how old the earth is. Like, I'm not sure that that's actually what's going on. So if you want to ask the questions about the age of the earth or the evolutionary process, by all means, ask the questions. Is the earth younger than science as a, you know, kind of a standard scientific answer would say? Maybe it is. I don't know, but I'm pretty certain that that's not scripture's primary focus.
Yeah.
It's about how to live in relationship with God. That's what it's on about. Mm. And that, I think, then drives scripture. You know, I mean, I think it's interesting that Genesis 1-11, all those prologue stories that we have all the questions about, you know, was there a total flood and, you know, can we see it in the fall? So, like all those sorts of questions.
Yeah.
It's actually not very important in Genesis.
Mm.
Like, it's the first 11 chapters. It just hops, skips, and jumps to get to Abraham. Mm. That's the point of Genesis.
Yeah.
It's the Abraham story, because then it just slows right down. Mm. And we talk in detail about this guy. And the first 11 chapters are really just to explain why we needed Abraham.
Yeah.
Like, why did God choose Abraham? What was God doing in that? Well, he was doing something because the world was pretty messed up. Right? Like,
yeah.
Right. So, yeah, which is, again, a bit of an overstatement. It's not as if Genesis 1 to 11 are unimportant, but they're not as critical as we sometimes. We spend so much time talking about them. And yet the author, particularly when you think about Genesis as part of the Pentateuch, right? So it's the first book of the law, and the first 11 chapters are just the prologue to the first book of the five books of the law. And we spend all our time in Genesis 1.
Yeah, get over it, man.
Well, what Scripture would say, this is not that important to me.
Yeah.
Like the author, right? It's like, this is not the most important thing.
Yeah.
It'd be like, you know, reading the Harry Potter novels and just focusing on the room under the stairs. And that's the most important space because that's where the story begins. And we have to unpack the beginning of the story. So it's all about being under the stairs. And you're like, no.
I do feel it's significant because the Dursleys were abusive to Harry, and I just don't think that that's right. And I just need that to be said.
Yeah, but
there you go.
But if you're going to talk
then
about,
then you miss Dumbledore.
And if you're
and Dobby's not even in it. Dobby.
I'm reading Chamber of Secrets with Harper at the moment, so it's just a time.
We are putting like bombs of like totally controversial Christian stuff in here today. Evolution, it's a tick. Harry Potter, it's a tick. I love it. I love it. So
love
good.
You.
It totally makes sense to me that the Bible is not a fully accurate scientific document. They just didn't know. I have no doubt that they could have put that stuff in if it was given to them by God. Mm. But the readers of the day would have been like, what the heck are you talking about? Evolution and cells and atoms. And like, they just didn't understand it. So they were kind of interpreting things as they understood. Mm. Right?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. And the other thing about that is it's helpful, but it doesn't help us relate to God.
Yeah.
Right? Like, even if we could definitively say, I know exactly how the natural world came to be. Like, and we decided that we figured it all out. We've got all the evidence. We know exactly how old the earth was. We know all the various stages. We have all the missing links, right? Whatever whatever the case is.
Who cares?
Long or short, whatever it might be. That doesn't actually do anything for our relationship with God. It doesn't call us to faithfulness. It's just a set of facts. And facts, you know, as you pointed out, you know, I think that the wonder of creation is not enough to inspire faith, just like the miracles of Jesus wasn't enough to inspire faith.
Yeah.
The Jewish leaders saw him raise Lazarus from the dead and kind of went, we got to kill this guy. You're like, whoa, what? Like that sign doesn't tell you anything about who he might be. It doesn't give you, nope, faith and signs are unrelated. So knowing how the world was created isn't the focus of Scripture. Knowing how things developed isn't what God's interested in. He's like, as things are developing, are you going to be faithful to me?
Yeah.
That's the story of Scripture from beginning to end. And so I think when we start asking questions of fact of Scripture, we're kind of importing a very different set of questions. And I think some of it is, you know, historically, when, you know, evolutionary theory and scientific theory began to question the Bible, they began to question the inerrancy of Scripture. That became a really hot topic. You know, can Scripture actually have errors in it? And what if there's a scientific error? Does that crumble the whole thing? And all of those sorts of questions. I'm not sure that we're there anymore. Like, I think there's a sense that I'd like to think that even if they forgot to carry the one in First Chronicles, that my faith would be stronger than that. You know?
As our senior pastor, I also hope that.
Particularly if it was someone like me doing the math. Like,
seriously.
Well, there's a classic example. I think it's in First Chronicles. It's in the description of the temple. Right. And so I don't know if you remember, there was like, it was called the sea. It was this massive bronze bowl, right? Pool, really. They give you the circumference and the diameter. And on the basis of how you'd work out circumference and diameter, one of those two can't be right.
That's it. I'm out.
Right. Like just, and so for some people, they're like, well, we've got to explain that. And so they, you know, some say, well, the diameter was measured to the inside of the bowl And then the circumference and the diameter work or the outside, that kind of thing. And I'm like, I don't know that that's that important. Like, can it not be?
The mathematicians out there are dying inside.
Yeah,
right
you
now.
Know. But
someone who spent their whole life recreating this bowl just to prove that God was right. It's like, fine.
But I like, but see, but like, I think that's what's changed for us. I think we've gotten to the point where like saying, you know what, I'm not sure scripture needs to be accurate at that kind of level. You know, because it's ish, like it's close. So like, you know, there I am taking down the dimensions of stuff. You know, hey, how big's that thing? It's this and how long? Okay, good, close enough, you know. it's not a critical detail. Yeah. And if that rocks our faith, if we kind of go, well, if scripture's not entirely 100% scientifically accurate, then I can't have faith in it. I'm like, I don't
good
know. Yeah, like good luck.
Good luck with anything.
Yeah, like I just think I think our faith is more robust than that. And I think the message of scripture is different than that, you know? Now, if it were riddled with errors, you'd be like...
You'd raise an eyebrow.
Yeah, you'd raise an eyebrow. But again, I don't think it is. You know, and I mean, that's always intriguing to me when people say, oh, you know, scripture's full of mistakes. I think one of the great responses is just to say, well, if I give you a Bible, would you find them?
Go and have a look.
Challenge.
Because it sounds like a Facebook fact.
Yeah.
I read on Facebook that the Bible is riddled with errors. Okay, well, here's a Bible. Why don't we read it together?
Something Matt would say.
Are you saying that Jupiter is not saving us from a meteor attack? Guys. They had a diagram.
I'm sold.
But you know what I'm saying? Like, it sounds like just one of those things that I think for someone who's opposed to the faith, I think that becomes something that they want to be true. So it's like, well, let's have a look. Well, let's have a look at that it's riddled with errors. Show me where they are. And when you kind of look at the inconsistencies, it's like, if you're going to discount an entire faith over those.
Over the circumference of a bowl.
Yeah. Like, it's probably not worth believing in anyways. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, but I think there's more to it than that. So.
Yeah, look, I'm never going to know the Bible as well as you, Dr. Mark Rader.
It's Reverend Doctor.
Oh, sorry, Reverend Doctor. You obviously studied a lot. You know mostly the ins and outs. And if you're comfortable with it and its inconsistencies, then I'm happy to take that as fact. I don't need to go into the depths of the
Bible. You can just post that on Facebook right now and we will like, share, and comment.
Well, I remember years ago hearing someone, it was someone's testimony. He was a fairly significant, I think he was a figure in banking and had sat on like treasury committees with the federal government, like so pretty significant individual. And his story of coming to faith was that his wife started going to church and he basically started showing up kind of to support her, but was just not at all into it. And the minister kind of really leaned into him a little bit and just kind of went, you're not into this at all. And he's like, no, I'm not. And they just kind of opened this conversation, which says a lot about the minister and about this fellow. And at any rate, I still remember he talked at some point. I mean, they'd had a number of conversations along the way about some of his questions about faith and blah, 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 blah. And one day the minister took him to like the theological library and showed him the apologetics shelf, which is all about like the defense of the faith. Just showed him all the books that they had in that collection, which was not at all the entire collection on earth, right? And just kind of said, these are the ways that people have solved the questions. And this fellow's response to that was essentially to say about himself, I was incredibly humbled in that moment because I had had the arrogance to assume that my questions would bring Christianity to its knees. And yet, for thousands of years, Christians, very intelligent men and women, had been thinking about those same questions and had come to a point of being able to put their faith in those things for very good, valid reasons. And the questions that he had, the concerns that he had, that he was so certain were like, this is why faith is stupid, right? He was just kind of like, oh. And there is an inbuilt arrogance in that statement, right? Where people are like, oh, yeah, Christianity is rubbish, you know, because I heard this, that, or the other thing. You're like, well, you think you're the first person to think of that?
Have you looked at the gravitational pull of Jupiter? That's all I want to say.
And I think that there's and the reason I share that is because it's always given me then a great deal of confidence, right? Not because I know the Bible you know, inside and out, you know, or because I've figured out all the questions that people might have. Oh, there's a bunch of stuff. I'm like, I don't know. Beats me. I don't know how to answer that question. But I have confidence that very godly, very wise men and women have answered those questions and come to a particular perspective of faith. And I go, okay, I stand in a tradition of faith. And there is some faith involved, but I think I can say confidently that if, you know, if all those other people believed it, I think I can probably find the place to kind of have confidence in it as well. Kind of, you know, we find confidence through other people in that sense. And we do need to know that, you know, Christianity has been through a lot. You know, lots of people ask lots of questions and Christianity's still around.
Yeah.
So I think that's pretty valuable for us too.
Mm. Right on. Whoa. There was a lot to unpacking that. But Mark, thanks so much. Thanks for your reflections. Thanks for this discipleship cycle and, you know, everything that you've kind of shared in it. We've loved every second of it.
It's been great. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Jessica Baker.
Matthew Willis.
what's standing out for you in amongst all of that?
I was full ready to go gung-ho, let's recycle and give up meat. I loved the direction this conversation went in. Stuff that.
Give me some lamb. some
no,
ribs.
Definitely not. We are stewards of this earth. Let's protect it. But that's my only point on that. I am so much more comfortable with the concept of the Bible and science and knowing that it's not one or the other. You don't have to, you know, fully hands down believe the creation story and it's 7 days, all that kind of stuff. And ignore all the evidence of evolution and things. And I also love that idea of like people have answered these, like Christians have been brave enough to ask these questions of their faith and have come up with the answers.
Yeah.
And yeah, I just really like that.
I want to know if that guy that Mark was talking about, like, did he read the books or were the books intimidating enough? Okay. He's like, yep, I see that. I see you on the shelf. I guess I'll give my life to Jesus.
The pastor was like hot gluing the covers on. I was like, these will be great. Great prop. I can just show everyone. There's nothing on the inside. Yeah, that would be a great thing. We should get one of those in our church, a fake library of evidence.
What, either become a Christian or read all these books?
Yeah. I'll choose the Lord, thank you. I mean, I would.
Sounds like a terrible way to evangelize.
I mean, it worked for that guy.
That can be the next big three.
Yeah.
But on that, like the whole like where you thought the conversation was going to go, I guess it also demonstrates for us that, you know, there's still so much more for us to talk about.
Yeah.
Like just on the topic of creation and how creation kind of plays a role in our discipleship, then, you know, I loved what Mark was sharing about how we understand who God is through creation, how we interact with science and how actually scripture is answering different questions. So you can't use it to answer the questions of science because it's actually that's not what it's trying to answer. And just the tool that is to engage in those conversations is really helpful. Mm. But then, it does then kind of open up a whole new array of questions of, okay, so what's my role in how we interact with the natural world and the moral world and how am I meant to be a disciple of Christ in that and how does that then shape my discipleship? I think, you know, we could talk about this for ages, but we already have been, so we won't. Well, Jessica Baker, thank you so much for joining us on this week's Big Three.
Thank you, Matt Willis. It was a delight.
Sheer delight. A sheer delight. We'll see you next time. And in 2 weeks, you'll be in the preacher's seat.
Oh,
cannot wait.
Don't even.
Be there.
Jesus,
it'll
take
be
the wheel.
Delightful. Well, if you want to be a part of the conversation, make sure you're there at one of our services on Sunday and that you snap the Slido QR code before the sermon to get involved. If you've enjoyed the Big Three podcast today, take the time to give a star rating and be sure to subscribe to stay up to date with all future episodes. Well, thanks for joining us for this week's Big Three and our deep dive into God's invitation for us all. Remember, there's no thought too small, no question too big.